cloudy skies at 71 degrees. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott, and we'll begin with this. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal has expanded a state of emergency to 24 additional counties. Now, initially it was Bryan, Camden, Chatham, Glenn, Liberty, and McIntosh. Now the total is 30, and there is a mandatory evacuation for some areas to begin Saturday. Joining me now from the WAB Newsroom is Senior Editor Susanna Capiluto, who will have more for us. Susanna, welcome.
Hey, Rose.
You all are busy down in the newsroom. Let's begin here. What are reporters working on? Who have you all spoken to?
We spoke to everybody, and about this. We've talked to emergency officials. We talked to the mayor of Tybee Island as they're getting ready. We talked to shelters that take in animals. We talked to students at Armstrong State College who are deciding whether or not to evacuate. Now, the governor has issued a mandatory evacuation just at 11:30 this morning for areas east of I-95, coastal areas. So those people have to get out starting Saturday.
When you talked to the mayor, what were their preparation like? What were they doing?
Well, they're just basically, everybody's watching, right? Mm-hmm. The storm is right down there and starting to hit Miami. It hasn't quite, what you call, made that turn yet. You know how the mm-hmm. forecasts have a turn in it. Mm-hmm. Once it makes that turn, a lot of things could happen. So they're really waiting. But to have an mandatory evacuation announced on a Thursday and the evacuation is Saturday is a smart move just so people can get ready and plan.
Any idea if you can't get out, if you don't have anywhere to go? I mean, did authorities...
Oh, they have shelters. It's very well organized. The state has, you know, Georgia has been through one of these evacuations mm-hmm. before and has learned a lot from it. One of them is the contraflow on I-16 mm-hmm. starting Saturday at 8 a.m. I-16, which connects sort of Savannah to the Metro Atlanta area, will only flow westward.
Really?
And you can't get into, you can't go eastbound, only westbound to get people out and into shelters.
And you and I both have copies here of Governor Deal's executive order, which is a couple of pages here. He's authorizing up to 5,000 Georgia National Guard members to be on state active duty.
Yes, absolutely. You need that after any disaster to secure areas, avoid looting, et cetera. And it's a good measure to have those in place ahead of time that they're ready to go, you know, if mm-hmm. Irma hits. There's still hope. I don't know. I'm optimistic. But
well,
yes.
So are a lot of the meteorologists. You know, Susanna, you look back to just last week with Hurricane Harvey, and obviously our state officials are learning a lot from what didn't or what did happen. This executive order is also including a provision related to price gouging.
Absolutely. This is the thing. Once you have a state of emergency in place in a county, you can't price gouge. If you have a hotel, you can't all of us, or if you sell water, you say, you know what, water is now $5 instead of $1. It's just illegal. And Georgia is very keen on this.
We went through this with gas.
Absolutely. It's like in this state, it's almost impossible to price gouge these days because they've been through this before and people have been prosecuted for it. It's it's something that, you know, they're very tough on.
The governor has scheduled a press conference for Friday morning. A lot of state officials will be there. Should we expect then a more detailed emergency preparedness plan and response efforts? A lot of folks are going to be there.
Absolutely. Anytime a hurricane moves up, the closer you get to it hitting, the more you will know and the more you will be ready. But what this order does, saying there is a mandatory evacuation for Saturday, it's people can start thinking about this and get going because it won't hit until Monday. So you have time to get out in an orderly fashion. This is a major storm. This is huge.
We're going to talk about this in terms of covering national disasters with Mike Oreskes from NPR a little bit later in the program. But I've known you for a long time. You've covered a lot of these natural events, and it's kind of old hat for you in terms of getting the troops ready to cover something like this. What's your number one, I guess, tip for journalists when they're out and they're covering a situation like this?
Well, the main thing you always say is stay safe, right?
Sure.
It's like stay out of the,
stay out of the way.
No, but there's a lot of information that people need that are evacuating. And in terms of Atlanta here, we will take in a lot of evacuees. Mm-hmm. And there are places, I think, on Facebook, they're setting up places where if you have an extra room, you know, why not take in an evacuee there, organizations like this. And we'll just have to figure out where can we help here. And if you do have relatives, of course, you know, you might take them in. So we're going to be a hospitable city, I think, for all the evacuees that come in from Florida and from the coast in the coming days. But then again, it hasn't made the turn yet. I'm an optimist. It could still not be so bad.
Well, and I have a friend who is coming up with her fiance, her cat, and her dog.
Great. I have a friend.
Now, I don't know if they're going to stay with me. We're still working out it out. But
what is interesting, if you've seen that the Atlanta Motor Speedway has opened up their campground, right? So they can take in thousands of RVs, and they're also allowing tents for free. So if you got your RV, you know, people bring it, they can go there and find a spot. So that's the kind of stuff you see the Atlanta metro area doing in order to help out.
And by the way, I would let my friends stay with me if they really need a place. From the WAB newsroom, senior editor Susanna Capiluto with the latest regarding Georgia's preparation for Hurricane Irma. Good to have you up. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Rose.
And as expected, Hurricane Irma is causing a lot of disruptions for air travelers. And with the title of the world's busiest airport, Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International is also making preparations. I called up airport spokesperson Andrew Goble, who was busy. Andrew, thanks for taking the time.
Sure, Rose. Good afternoon. We're going to stop meeting like this.
I know. We've been busy. Listen, let's begin here because you are among a team of airport officials, all communicating with federal agencies and other airports. Take us through what the behind-the-scenes process is like right now.
Well, communications is most important, you know, and making sure that everyone is aware of what is going on and what is happening. So in a few minutes, we're all going to sit in on a conference call with some of the area meteorologists to determine what's going to take place. A short time ago, I just left a meeting where we were talking about operationally what we were going to do to prepare for the storm, and that covers everything from staffing issues to fire and police and law enforcement personnel to making sure that we've got enough host kits for passengers who may be stranded here at the airport. There's a great deal of planning and preparation that goes into this. One of the positives that's coming out of this as we're taking a look right now is obviously we will not be dealing with, and I certainly don't want to jinx it, but it looks through the forecasts as if we will not be dealing with hurricane force winds and rainfall, but our partner airports throughout the area are. So we're offering, as we did with Harvey last week, you know, support and words of encouragement. And if there's anything we can do to assist, that's what we're doing.
Thousands are evacuating from the areas in the path of Irma. How is that affecting air travel right now into Hartsfield-Jackson?
We are seeing an influx of some of the passengers who are coming on in. However, there are airports that have had cancellations and airlines that have cancellations. Yesterday, we had 11 cancellations. Today, we've got 15. We expect tomorrow 17. And we also expect that those numbers will increase as well. So that's one of the things that we're continuing to monitor. And as you and I discussed last week, keep in mind, we host between 260 and 270,000 passengers every day. So this is a very small amount of passengers that we're dealing with. And if we have more coming in here, we understand that as well. But we're doing everything we can to make sure that they are treated well, they are taken care of. We're working with our airlines to make sure that the passengers who are coming in are prepared and are comforted here in Atlanta.
And for anyone who had plans to travel over the next 3 to 4 days to South Florida or anywhere near Irma's path, what are your suggestions?
First and foremost, monitor your airline's communication channels. Social media is ideal, and that's one of the channels that we use to get our message out. So go on and take a look and follow their Twitter feed, follow their Facebook pages, because that is a very current, a very updated source of information. Communicate with them, call them, email them, go on their websites and determine what's going on, what their plans are. And it's not just in the southeastern United States. Keep in mind that the air transport system is an interdependent system. So what is going on here in Atlanta affects not just nationwide, but worldwide. Mm-hmm. So when we're dealing with cancellations and changed plans throughout the Southeast, we're dealing with cancellations and changed plans throughout the nation.
You know, last week, Andrew, of course, it was Harvey, and now Irma. That's two major tropical storms, hurricanes back to back. Have you ever had to deal with something like that?
I am relatively new to this position. I've been here for just about 2.5 years. But in my time here, I have seen how professional and how conscientious the employees here at the airport are, those who work for the airlines, those who work for the Department of Aviation. And I'm sure that they have had to deal with this in years past. I actually come from a broadcasting background, and I was at one time a weathercaster, and I can remember dealing with hurricanes coming one after the other. I thought it was busy at that point dealing with it, but even now here in the transportation industry where everything is interdependent, it's even more so. But we're confident that we can handle it. We're confident that we can offer the support and the assistance that our friends and colleagues across the Southeast need.
What about with cargo shipments that come in and out of the airport? Is there a different process in handling that as well?
When the storms are coming in, if we are going to be impacted by hurricane force or tropical storm force winds, then yes, we will, if need be, close it down. But we don't foresee that happening. We expect to see our cargo operations up and running as normal.
As we wrap up, I want to just get an update on whether or not things are back to normal for travel into and around the Houston area. Last week when we talked about it, of course, it was day-to-day. Have those daily operations returned to normal?
As far as we know, yes. The daily operations have returned to normal. I wouldn't consider that. The cleanup after a hurricane is going to take quite some time. But so far, the operations to Houston, both airports in Houston, are up and running. When you're traveling to Houston, as soon as you arrive, I would expect that you would see the effects of the storm itself.
Wow. Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport spokesperson Andrew Gobiel, as always, we appreciate you taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Of course, Rose, anytime. Let's try not to do this in the future, though.
All right. Take care, Andrew.
Sure. Bye.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is committed to providing dependable internet service for businesses who depend on it. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV, built for business. And from the University of Georgia in Gwinnett. You can earn your graduate degree while working full-time. More about UGA's programs for working professionals at the Gwinnett Campus Open House on October 21st, gwinnett.uga.edu.
Listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. The U.S. mainland prepares for Hurricane Irma.
All of Florida is on alert.
The storm is bigger, faster, and stronger than Hurricane Andrew. Every Floridian should take this seriously and be aggressive to protect their family.
That's next time on Here and Now, this afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. As residents in Houston and other areas of Texas are in the process of rebuilding, we can all remember the images and sounds of the damage Hurricane Harvey left. It will linger for some time, and now there's Hurricane Irma. And as with any major event, and especially a natural disaster, it's the job of news outlets to cover.
Now to Houston and the devastation that city is facing due to Hurricane Harvey.
We're in the outskirts of Houston on the western side. We're actually pulled over in a residential neighborhood right now looking at a lot of street flooding. trying to pick the best route from here, which has basically been the story of the whole day. It's kind of a stop-and-go sort of thing with flooded streets and road closures.
Epi Mungia is overseeing a makeshift distribution center in the middle of a sweltering hot strip center parking lot in his hometown of Orange, Texas. This parking lot is where the National Guard and volunteer rescuers first brought people displaced by floodwaters.
We went to Cypress Creek. It's this neighborhood north of Houston that is completely submerged. Bill Dan and his cousin Matthew Hernandez have a fishing boat. They were just doing these volunteer rescues, and we got on their boat near this bridge where they were launching.
That's a series of reporting from NPR. Now, as reporters and hosts, we are committed to providing coverage under those basic tentacles of journalism. But when there's human suffrage, what's the most ethical and respectful way to cover an event like Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Irma? Well, Mike Oreskes is NPR's Senior Vice President of News and Editorial Director, so I called him up. He joined me on the line from NPR in Washington, D.C. Mike, as always, welcome back to the program.
Greetings, Rose. Thanks for inviting me back.
Let's begin with this. Outside of the local affiliate, the reporters there, do you know the total number of NPR reporters, editors, photojournalists, and hosts that y'all sent down to cover Harvey?
Well, I don't know exactly, and that's because, of course, NPR itself has sent quite a number of people. Mm-hmm. You heard several of them in the audio you just played. And our colleagues in Austin and Dallas and Boston and San Antonio have all sent help as well. But certainly there's more than 20 public radio journalists there beyond our colleagues at Houston Public Media who've done such a heroic job.
Absolutely.
Keeping things going.
How do y'all decide how much personnel will be needed when an event like Harvey is taking place?
Well, it's more art than science. We have a number of people who've got a lot of experience at these kind of natural disaster stories, but of course each of them is different and each of them has different challenges. One of the first people into Houston was our Southern Bureau Chief, Russell Lewis, who, of course, you guys in Atlanta know well as well. And he's, boy, there are not many people in journalism know more about particularly hurricanes and natural disaster. So he's actually been deploying people. And you know, the general rule of thumb at the beginning of a thing like this is it's easier to call people back than it is to send more. So we tend to send a lot of people, and then if we've overdone it, we'll bring them back. Of course, in this case, I'm sorry to say, if anything, we're going to need more help over time. And we're now looking at the long haul. And in fact, Russell is over at Houston Public Media today exploring what we need to build for a kind of long-term plan for covering the damage done to the city and the people of Houston.
Why the decision to send the program host of Morning Edition and All Things Considered?
It's a good question. And as you know, as a host, yes, authenticity and being there really does make a difference. And, you know, we're lucky enough at NPR to have some resources and the money to get, thanks to all of our listeners and sponsors, we have the support to get them down there. And I think, you know, David Green, who was down there for Morning Edition, I think really showed the value of that. The coverage, when they found themselves essentially trapped at their hotel and they couldn't even get downtown, and yet the way in which they described their own plight helped explain how serious the plight of Houston was. So it makes a difference, you know, and we do try to get our hosts out on the road. You know, David was in Houston, as we said, David Green. And of course, he'd been not that long ago. He'd been in Moscow because that's a big story for us as well.
But what precautions or measures do you all go through at NPR to make sure this deployment that you all are sending, that safety is number one for them as well?
Yeah. And the first point is, as you just said, Rose, safety is number one. There is no story that's worth a life or even serious injury. These kind of disasters are even more challenging because, of course, so many of our colleagues are in the middle of the story themselves. So they are in danger both as citizens and as journalists. So, you know, one issue, of course, is as our colleagues at Houston Public Media are experiencing, we have colleagues who've lost their cars, lost their houses, couldn't get to work because of the dangers. And so they had to figure out how to stay safe just in terms of trying to get to work, for example. And we know, obviously, a police officer lost his life trying to get to work. But the other part of it is we do a lot of training beforehand for difficult situations. We have hazardous duty training, a hazardous circumstance training that we tried to put not only all of our NPR people through, but we've tried to make it available as much as we're able to for our station colleagues as well. That kind of training can't anticipate every dangerous situation, but what it does do is it tries to train people in being aware of their circumstances and being cautious in the circumstance. And then we try to pay a lot of attention to the circumstance, and we try to help people think through what they're doing, like the fact that the water is dangerous. I mean, that water carries a lot of dangerous material in it. And so being careful about how you you may need to put yourself in the water, but be careful about it.
You know, Mike, aside from the press conferences, obviously with national figures, for example, FEMA, or covering the president's arrival, getting that human interest story is always key. You and I both know that. But when there's human suffrage like this, and I know for a lot of people just listening or watching, they're saying, why is the media doing that? How do you balance that? How do you tell the reporters to and hosts to make sure that they're balancing?
Yeah, and you know, a lot of reporters feel that very personally and experience that. It's a difficult situation. You know, every reporter has to come up with their own way of addressing someone in these difficult situations to make sure that they have their consent to interview them. I mean, it really is about consent. And I mean, all of our people ask, of course. They say, are you prepared to be interviewed? But then there's an almost an empathy gene that I think triggers, which is very important, which is they may say yes, but do they really mean it? They may say no, and you need to accept that. But there are also people who actually want the story told but don't really know how to do it. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of people, as you said, who aren't the people we always and routinely interview. You know, the mayor, the governor, we assume they know how to handle themselves. But, you know, someone with all their belongings floating along in a raft, you know, that's a different thing. Of course, a lot of people want their story told, and a lot of people intuitively understand that telling their story may actually be part of getting help for their community. But we have an obligation to respect every individual's situation and to make sure we understand it.
You know, Mike, recently NPR received a lot of criticism from listeners about that interview between Elsa Chang and Brad Keiserman, disaster operations for logistics for the Red Cross. Were you aware of what all the feedback has been like?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, we heard it. And, of course, that all goes back to a series of pieces that we did about some of the Red Cross's handling of earlier disasters, and it's really about the allocation of their funds and how much of their funds actually get to the disaster scenes. The challenge that we've put before the Red Cross is based on our previous reporting. I think Elsa did a good job in that interview of posing the challenge. You know, I'm sorry that many listeners felt that that was inappropriate, but I actually think it is appropriate for us to be asking the major players in this, how are you doing and what are you doing, and to hold to account not just the government, which everybody recognizes we hold government to account, but we hold the other big players to account as well. And we asked the questions, and the Red Cross gave their answers, and obviously we'll be keeping a close eye on that.
But was Brad Keiserman the appropriate individual to question about that, you think?
Well, that's fair enough. And, you know, he was the person there before us. As you know, at the time of our earlier stories, we went to the very top of the Red Cross because obviously the ultimate CEO and other executives of the Red Cross are the ones responsible. He was there. He was on the air. She felt that, the questioning had to happen as part of the overall thing, and I don't second-guess that.
You mentioned that you all will still have ongoing coverage. How long do you anticipate NPR will be down there, sort of boots on the ground, and this could take a while?
I imagine this is going to be a story with us for quite some time. It's going to take Houston a time to recover. We're obviously talking very closely with Houston Public Media and with the stations in Texas, the rest of the stations in Texas. We collaborate very closely with them. And in fact, we had been down in Texas just a few weeks before the storm because, as you know, Rose, we're building a much more integrated public radio network around the country. And part of that is is hubs that we're building collaboratively with stations. And one of the first places we're looking to test that out is in Texas. And we had just been down there, several of us, a few weeks earlier, meeting with some of the key stations. So we're going to be there as long as it takes. And in some senses, we're going to be there forever because they are us.
You think about 9/11, the earthquake in Haiti. You think about Sandy. Does this rank in that sort of upper tier of disasters that NPR has had a long format, long form reporting about?
Probably. You know, we'll have to see. I mean, there's certainly going to be a lot of long-term issues, and we'll obviously look to our colleagues in Houston to kind of guide us on how the debate takes place in Houston around that, the questions of how the Houston uses his its land, how Houston is zoned, flood insurance issues. I mean, there'll be a lot of long-term issues that matter to the whole country. And also, obviously, Houston is the fourth largest city in the country, is a very important place to the whole country on its face. So I think the recovery of Houston is a story the whole country needs to hear about.
Mike Oreskes is NPR's Senior Vice President of News and Editorial Director. As always, Mike, we appreciate you taking the time here on Closer Look.
Thank you, Rose.
Take care now.
Support for WABE comes from Capital One. You can open a Capital One savings account and discover more about Capital One savings online at CapitalOne.com/ReimagineAtlanta. Capital One, welcome to banking reimagined.
The news can shift on a dime.
In his statement on Twitter, President Trump said that the military...
Senate rejected legislation to dismantle Obamacare by...
To date, Red Cross in Georgia has deployed 52 workers to Texas and Louisiana.
When it does, all things considered, reports what we know and we chase after what we don't. We take the time for another question to look ahead and get at what the news means right now. Stand with the facts. Listen every day from 4 to 6:30. It's All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
And you heard Audie. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Developers and investors from everywhere seem to have their sights on Atlanta. Downtown Atlanta's on the verge of a major, and I do mean major, improvement. From the newly opened Mercedes-Benz Stadium to plans to redevelop Underground Atlanta. We're going to get to that in a moment, but just look everywhere. There are cranes and backhoes and people hammering and all kinds of stuff is happening. Well, heavily invested in the downtown area is the German-based company Newport Holdings. They recently acquired 50 properties in downtown Atlanta. I recently spoke to Catherine Kelly. She's the company's vice president of development to talk about their vision for the area. And our conversation began with Kelly giving a little background on the company Newport Holdings.
We are already vested in the area. We've made a deep commitment to this area and are really looking at delivering the first phases of the project over the next 5 years. So we, as you mentioned, already own or control about 50 buildings in what's essentially about an 8-city block area, and have actively begun envisioning and planning what we want that to look like.
Let's talk about that 8-city block. Lay out the boundaries for our listeners. What area are we talking about here specifically?
Sure. The area is south downtown. So we're east of the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium and Phillips Arena, south of Underground and Woodruff Park, west of the Turner Field redevelopment. So essentially, it's the core of what was the original commercial shopping district for the city, mm-hmm. and really the oldest part of Atlanta.
So what are you looking at here? I mentioned mixed-use development. Is that primarily we're going to be looking at, or office space here, or a combination of both?
Yes, it's about 750,000 square feet with a mix of uses. And as we think about our vision for the next 5 years and 10 years, we're envisioning creating a great city neighborhood that's an exciting place to be part of. So in those 8 city blocks, we would envision lively, walkable streets, a diverse group of people and price points and products, exciting restaurants and retail services, creative businesses, new residential places to live in these wonderful historic properties, beautiful historic architecture. We're very excited about rejuvenating the historic buildings that are there.
Give me an example.
One of our favorites is the original Rich's department store. It's called M. Rich, mm-hmm. the M. Rich building. This is a place, you know, for me personally, Riches has a magical history. I and so many Atlantans remember the Pink Pig, mm-hmm. and you know the Christmas tree and the Crystal Bridge nearby. There are so many Atlantans that have wonderful stories about these buildings and about the history of this area, and we're very excited about bringing back that history as we turn the lights on in these old buildings that essentially have been boarded up or vacant for decades.
And that's been a growing concern. Can you bring about new development with existing buildings, foundations, without tearing them down? We've had conversations before on this program about how do we preserve, you know, the history of Atlanta through its architecture without tearing it down and putting up a fancy building. Can you do that with all these properties, or will some of them you have to start from scratch, so to speak?
Absolutely. In fact, the history of the buildings are one of the most important things that attracted us to this opportunity to begin with. And yes, with rare exception, we may need to selectively replace pieces and parts, but our plan, and really the first thing we plan to focus on, is to renovate and rejuvenate these historic buildings. We feel like we have found the last and largest remaining piece of commercial historic fabric in the city, and it's a crown jewel that we intend to protect and take forward and really enliven as a sort of the core of the project that we're doing.
You mentioned the old Riches Building. Give us some other landmarks that people listening can say, wow, okay, now I get where they're going.
Yeah. The original Haverty's Furniture Store was right there next to the Imrich Building. Cress has a building on Peachtree Street in the middle of where we are working. The Kessler Lofts and Kessler. You know, what's interesting is we're finding that so many of the great retail businesses of our city got their start in this area. Mm-hmm. This was the beginning. And even if later they moved to the mall or moved further north, there's a wonderful entrepreneurial history to what's right here in this district. So there are lots of families and layers of history and businesses that we intend to re-energize and start telling those stories again.
Often when I go to a city and I always want to know what the downtown life is like, I'm from St. Louis where we have a thriving downtown. I remember when I moved here and people were like, well, Atlanta's downtown, it's kind of boring. And, mm-hmm. you know, people just kind of, they take the train or they go where they need to go. So it wasn't really thriving. And even today I hear people say, yeah, it's not really thriving. There's nothing happening. So you all feel like with some of your development, you can sort of encapsulate that atmosphere as well to get people to move in to these live, work, play. You know, will they have something to do in terms of being down there? And what role can you all play in that? Because if you put up a nice complex, a nice apartment building or a condo building, that's great. But if people move there, they want to be able to do something.
Absolutely. I think part of our focus is in rebalancing the mix of what's there. There's obviously a tremendous office presence in downtown Atlanta, but really has not had a very deep residential base. So that's an important part of what we intend to create going forward. Likewise, on the retail front, there's a wonderful burgeoning arts community that mm-hmm. we very much intend to nurture and grow. We see it as a great opportunity for entertainment-type businesses that can complement the sports activities going on adjacent to where we are. It's really thinking broadly about a very diverse mix of uses that can complement what's already there, but not necessarily replace what's already there.
And let's talk about affordable housing, because we've been talking about that since the beginning of 2017 here on this program. Will you all have some affordable housing options in any of these properties, in any of these developments that you're working on?
Yes, absolutely. It's a critical issue for us. And it's obviously a critical issue for the city that's getting a lot of attention. We like to think about affordability from a holistic perspective. It's not just about the size of the rent check, which absolutely is fundamentally important and something we're committed to. But it's also thinking about how can we create an affordable lifestyle. So, for example, how can we design a community where you don't have to own a car to get around? How can we design energy-efficient buildings with lower utility bills? How can we create a place where residences are in walking distance to their jobs or to healthy fresh food. When you start to add up multiple elements of affordability, that's when we feel that we can really begin to get some traction on this issue.
We're speaking with Catherine Kelly, Executive Vice President of the Newport Holdings, and she's talking about the development taking place in downtown Atlanta. You mentioned phase one. Again, reset that for me. Where is it, and what's the timeline in terms of it being completed?
So phase one will really be focused on the renovation of the historic buildings. There are about 50 or so of those buildings, and our goal would be essentially over the next 5 years to renovate those buildings with a mix of uses, ground floor retail and commercial spaces with creative businesses and residences on the upper floors. Hopefully, if we've done our job right, we will have the very early phases of that starting to deliver next year. And again, sort of rolling out over the following 5 years. Longer term, you know, this is easily a 10-year project because mm-hmm. we also have a lot of parking lots in the neighborhood that are a great opportunity for new development. And our goal would be to really wean people off of their automobiles and replace those parking lots ultimately with new buildings and create some sort of progressive blending of the old and the new.
You mentioned coming into this segment that Newport, this was nothing new in terms of development in other areas of the nation. Is there a city or another region of the country you can point to and say this is a template of what we plan to do? Or is each one different, totally different?
Great question. We love to study the cities that have stood the test of time. We're also very interested in places that have really rediscovered their downtowns and their historic building fabric. So cities like Denver, Los Angeles, for example, have wonderful models of, you know, pieces of these types of projects that are occurring. And our goal would be to take the lessons learned from those places, but bring them into Atlanta in a way that's appropriate and local and specific to our history and our people and our community, so they feel real for us as a city.
Catherine Kelly is the company's vice president of development. We're talking about Newport Holdings, and they've acquired 50 properties in the downtown area. Thank you so much for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Community issues are what drives the conversations here on Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Tell me what's happening where you live. Send an email to rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
On the next Fresh Air.
So many friends from college have become successful.
The new film Brad Status stars Ben Stiller as someone overcome by corrosive jealousy of old college friends who are more successful than he is. I'll talk with the film's writer and director, Mike White, who also wrote the film School of Rock and created the HBO series Enlightened. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Let's go down memory lane to 1969. Now, according to Billboard Music, this was a top song of the year.
Sugar.
Now, Sugar Sugar by the Archies, it was a cool song. But for me, even though technically I wasn't on Earth, this is the top song of 1969. Sometimes I'm right, and I can be wrong. Sly Stone, y'all, everyday people. If you disagree, send me an email, rose@wabe.org. Anyway, many of you, our beloved WAB listeners, remember 1969 because it's the year the Underground Atlanta opened. There was a lot of promise. Remember, it would include small shops, restaurants, bars, music venues, all of that. Well, downtown Atlanta is changing. We know that. It's a neighborhood in transition. You got the Mercedes-Benz Stadium that's now open for business. You got multiple developers that have purchased property in the area. And one of the developers is South Carolina-based real estate investment management company, WRS. They finally reached an agreement with the City of Atlanta, and they purchased Underground Atlanta. So what's in store in terms of development? Well, the COO, Steve Howell, says they have a plan. He joins me in studio, as well as urban planner Dimitri Batches from the consulting firm Metrocology. Thank you guys for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Fantastic to be here.
Y'all remember 1969?
That's slightly before my time.
Yeah, same.
Let's begin with this. Tell us about WRS. This is a South Carolina-based and real estate investment company, correct?
Yeah, we've done development all across the Southeast for more than 20 years. The current ownership has really been in place for the last 10 to 15 years. And over the last 2 years, we've really done a significant push away from traditional neighborhood grocery store development into urban areas and into urban redevelopment.
Let's talk about that. Define what traditional urban neighborhood development
is. What you see anytime you're driving up the street in the suburbs where you see a grocery store and the stream of little shops mm-hmm. next to it with a fast food restaurant out in front.
You've got a vitamin shop, you've got a sushi place, you've got haircuts, you've got all of that.
Exactly.
Is that not cool anymore?
Demographic trends are actually really working in the favor of what we're trying to do here in Underground Atlanta.
How do you determine demographic trends? Dimitri, what does that look like?
You know, it's a series of things that come together in terms of the desire of people and the aspirations that they have based on their age, when they were brought up and where they were brought up. A lot of the trends nowadays are that the younger set of people and the older set of people, those two groups, which are huge, two-thirds of the population basically, are very much eager to be back in a situation or an environment where they have a lot more mobility options, typically walking. And that's a whole different pattern of land use on the ground than it was in that 70s, 80s period when it was all car-based.
So when do you think this trend started? I always like to blame things on the millennials because they're an easy group, but I don't think that's fair in this case.
No, I don't think it's fair either. I think it's a pent-up demand thing. Mm-hmm. For the longest period of time, most of this country was built based on a model that Steve just talked about, right? You have your shopping center, mm-hmm. your Jim and Nick's, your gas stations, your subdivisions. That works for a good chunk of the population, but it also doesn't work for a good chunk of the population. And eventually, that sort of the cost of doing only that is what has made become people more aware of the fact that there need to be more options, that sort of urban infill that you're seeing in Atlanta now.
And does that correlate with the desires of people that you talked about, Steve?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really what we're trying to service here.
So what was it about the Underground Atlanta area? Because it's not really big, technically. What was it about that area that attracted you all?
There's a couple of things that really attracted us to this area. The first is recognizing those bigger demographic trends, people wanting to come back into an urban setting. But what was really unique about Underground Atlanta is you have the Five Point Station. Mm-hmm. And when you are talking about, if you go to the millennials just for a second, you know, you see a lot of people who are in that age group that aren't driving anymore. And so public transportation becomes absolutely key. And so to have, even though this isn't a huge piece of property, it's a good sized piece of property for an urban area, especially right next to a major, transit center.
Before you all enter into negotiations with the City of Atlanta, is there some sort of feasibility study that you all do? Dimitri, I imagine this is probably where you will come in as well.
Not initially from a marketing point of view. There's a sort of a general understanding, an informed observation that people can make who've been doing this enough that there are specific sites that might be underutilized at the moment. And that's when you get brought in to flesh out what that might look like.
Steve, as you know, there was a lot of talk about what to do with Underground Atlanta. You all finally reached a deal with the City of Atlanta with nearly $35 million here. Is that, are you getting the best for your bottom dollar here?
You know, I think that it's a good opportunity for us. But that price point really is what's going to enable us to do a very unique development here. And that's really what we talked about with the mayor and with the city going into the process was this wasn't going to be just your ordinary average, we're going to build a high-rise apartment building right here. Mm-hmm. Is we wanted to do something really unique with this area, and so this gives us the flexibility to be able to do that.
How were the negotiations like? Pretty smooth?
Actually, very smooth. The actual negotiations, the people think of the you know, price, time, all of that. That stuff went very smoothly with the city. They were great to work with. The complications came in how complicated this piece of property is. The extensive amount of easements that we have. We have a railroad track running through it. We have the MARTA line going underneath it. And then just that doesn't even come, you know, like you said, 1969 was the start of what we think of as underground today, but it existed before that as well. So the surveys and all of that involved stuff is what really took the time.
You talked to the city and the mayor, and you told them of your plan. Did you reach out to the community and in the neighborhoods? And that's really big here. We talk about that a lot on this program because the community wants to know what's coming into their neighborhood. Did you reach out to those organizations and NPUs?
We have, and we've gotten even a little bit more active in that lately as we've really started to solidify more of what our plans are. We had some initial visions on what we wanted to do, but until we really got in there and started talking to different partners to bring in multifamily, to bring in retail, and bring in these other features that we wanted, all of that's going to alter the design in different ways. And so we've been able to, not only have we agreed to have a community outreach program, which we agreed to with the city on the forefront, but that's what we're really trying to reach out to now, and that's really solidified the communication that we have with the neighbors around us.
So, Dimitri, let's bring you back to the conversation. Urban planner, what's your role in all of this?
My role is to sort of orchestrate the hardware and the software components of this project. I mean, hardware, we talk about buildings, Steve mentioned, you know, multifamily and retailers and so forth. But the software component that you were mentioning about the social side, the community side, what it is that needs to activate these buildings and how it comes together in a way that leverages the strength that this site has and makes it something that's a positive for the community. I sit in between all that.
Will you all, and Steve, I know you have some plans here, and I was really excited. It was like, you know, getting, you know, the plans to the Batcave or something. But with these plans that you all have, let's start with that. So what will Underground Atlanta, or can we still call it Underground Atlanta?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that what you're going to call it?
You know, at least a section of it. What we're really trying to do is acknowledge the fact that this is four different blocks. All right, so if you think about it, if you have the MARTA Five Point Station on the west and you have Central Avenue on the east side and then Wall Street on the north and Martin Luther King Jr. on the south side, you actually have a T intersecting it, and that's Pryor Street and Alabama Street. And so each of those quadrants can create something unique. We want them all to be related, but they don't have to be dependent upon each other.
There are some smaller retail businesses around there. What exactly did you all acquire then? Let's sort of give our listeners the exact picture here of what you all acquired.
Okay, so what we would call Block 1 in the way I was just describing it is basically bounded by Peachtree Street on the west, Wall Street on the north, Pryor Street on the east, and Alabama Street on the south. That would be Block 1. Mirror that over, and you have Pryor Street on the west and Central Avenue on the east would be Block 2. And then if you flip Alabama Street, we have all of the typical thing that you think of with underground, everything that's lower Alabama Street. But we also have above on upper Alabama Street, those existing buildings that front Alabama Street along the frontage there on both sides of Pryor Street going east and west.
Development obviously happens in phases. Let's talk about phase one. Where are we and what is phase one?
Phase one is probably going to grow to be phase one and phase 1A. We've had a lot of acceleration. You were talking earlier on your show about the amount of activity in downtown Atlanta, and we're starting to see that really happen. So phase one was originally going to be what we would call Block 2, up by Wall Street and Central Avenue, basically the closest piece of property to the university.
Okay.
And so we were kicking off phase one with some new student housing, with some retail, ground floor retail. And what we're also working then is covering those tracks, the MARTA tracks, because they're open air just in that one little section. And we would cover that and put some other multifamily up above there with some other retail on the ground floor as well.
Now, we hear that term, you know, mixed use, multifamily a lot. So what exactly, when you say that, we're talking about condos, apartments, what are we talking about here?
This will, no condos.
No condos,
no
just
condos.
Apartments.
So apartments. So we have student housing on one section, and then we have just traditional multifamily apartments on the other.
If you all, I know you all are Charlotte-based, or Charleston-based, so I don't know if you've been able to listen to this program a lot, but we've been talking a lot about affordable housing, and some developers have said, you know, they have an interest in maybe securing 15 to 20% of their developments slated for affordable housing. simple question, does that include you all?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a requirement of 15% on our project, but what we've been really talking with, we've talked to a couple of different partners that look to exceed that percentage as well.
Really?
Yes.
That people would love to hear that. So what's phase two?
Phase two is we're really readapting what we want to do in the actual underground, what people think of as right. The underground. And so we've come up with a new set of plans. We're trying to adapt what goes in there to be something that's really cool and unique, get away from the mall that it was trying to be, mm-hmm. and be a good mixture of some cool, I mean, some of those old buildings down there and offer a really unique office type mm-hmm. setting. So we think we can get some really cool businesses down there, what we're calling the makers, people that are actually making, doing things, and then some very unique retail components as well.
Dimitri, when we talk about those trends and what he talked about in terms of how unique the underground portion is that part of the trends that people want to be part of something that has a little bit of history to it, but has a different flavor? You know, we always think about incubators and how they attract, you know, startups and things like that. So that underground area, does it lend itself to being something unique to attract retail or you know, businesses to come in that want to work underground?
Very much so. I mean, the character of a place like that, like you said, is unique. And that's what a lot of newer businesses and people that are looking to sort of shed the staid and average look of the things in the suburbs, that's the places that they're attracted to. You know, in Atlanta now, you can see that area west of Atlantic Station, all that industrial property out there is becoming a very hip mm-hmm. and great place to be. Underground Atlanta will be the underground version of that. It's really interesting.
You all always want to be good stewards of the neighborhood. And so do you anticipate that you'll be able to go through all these phases, have your property develop, and then everyone be happy? We have something for everyone.
Our hope is to make everyone happy. I know in reality, having everyone be happy.
I want you to say everyone will be happy, Rose.
We want to make as many people happy as we can because we want them all to come down here, whether they're going to move in and live down here. We want them to shop down here. We want people to work down here.
But there is something we talk about a lot on this program too, which is preserving the history and preserving culture. We talked about this with the Grant Park neighborhood not too long ago, because, you know, new development is great, but at the same time, can you preserve some of the history and the culture of the underground area? You think about the Civil War. I mean, we can get into Confederates. I'm not talking about that, but civil rights, you know, arts. That area has a lot of history to it. So do you take that into account as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think besides, you know, Dimitri being interested in creating a real, you know, what he calls the fabric of a place, the unique character of it. You know, I have a little bit of a background in historic preservation as well. So I am very cognizant of the history and trying to find ways to incorporate that into what we're trying to do.
And before we get you out of here, because this is also a big deal, you know, people want to be able to just go downtown to Atlanta, get off the train maybe. Do you want people to drive to this area? Do you want them to take the train and then just walk around and enjoy all what you all have to offer?
Our goal would be everybody taking the train down there. We don't want to we don't even want to have to create all these new parking spaces to accommodate everything that's going to be built there.
Are you prepared to tell me you will not build another parking garage or parking deck in downtown Atlanta? Can either one of you guarantee that?
Can we guarantee that? No, we can't guarantee that. Do we want to make it as minimal as possible? Absolutely.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate it. Steve Heil, Dimitri Batches, thank you all for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it. When will all this be done?
It's going to take a few years to get all of this off the ground, and construction on some of these projects is going to be, you know, 12, 18 months in and of itself. So it'll be a few years before it really takes off.
I appreciate it, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Closer Look, of course, is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Fox. And our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer, Christine Dempsey. A special thanks to the entire WAB News team and Public Broadcasting Atlanta's digital services crew because they keep us on the web. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. From WABE 90.1 Atlanta, I'm Rose Scott.